Today, additional viewers' questions answered. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. What's the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour? Last night, we ran our live stream event. It was very successful. We had more than 1,000 concurrent viewers and participants, and we had a wide-ranging discussion. However, because there were so many questions being asked in real time, I did not cover the questions submitted beforehand. So this post is going to discuss the questions which I didn't get around to answering on the live stream. I did promise I would provide some answers, and that's what we're going to do now. Please note, this is not financial advice. I'm not allowed to give financial advice. I don't know your personal circumstances. This is my general opinions based on my research, quite extensive research, but please don't take this as financial advice. A few people have grizzled because they're claiming I said X and, you know, Y's happened. Well, you know, this is just my opinion, so take it or leave it, but please, it's not financial advice. I'm not willing, cannot give it. So the first question comes from Peter. I've been watching your collaborations, John Adams, reading your blog recently, and had a couple of questions. Can you recommend an alternative to using big banks or any ADIs that may put savings at risk under potential bail-in conditions? Under said bail-in conditions, how could superannuation be affected, and how could one protect against any risks of this? So Peter, that's a very good question. The first thing to say that bail-in is very unclear in Australia. In New Zealand, it's transparent. In Australia, it's not. But the assumption, I think, would have to be that the banks with the higher risk profiles are potentially more likely to require bail-in in a crisis. And the typical risk profiles would be higher loan portfolios in terms of interest-only loans, in terms of mortgages, perhaps, and also derivatives. And especially if they're funding their portfolios from the financial markets rather than from deposits. So my own strategy has been to focus on smaller banks, credit unions, building societies, that have no derivatives exposures, that fund the majority of their books from deposits, and are perhaps a little smaller and less concerned about generating profits. A lot of mutuals, of course, are there for the mutual benefit of its members rather than to generate profits. So my own strategy to avoid bail-in has been to avoid the big four, avoid some of the regionals, and consider credit unions and building societies. Now, your second question relates to superannuation. Now, of course, if you have a superannuation account sitting at the bank, and it's basically a deposit account within your self-managed super fund, that will be at risk just like any other account. But if it is one that is essentially part of a larger superannuation fund, in other words, trustees managed on your behalf, perhaps conglomerated, it's not clear to me whether there is bail-in on those types of deposits too. It's just not clear. So the whole superannuation sector and the implications of bail-in is muddy, and at the moment there is no clarity. We may get clarity down the track, we may not. Remember, of course, that the government's official position is there is no bail-in policy in Australia, and therefore don't worry your pretty little heads about it. I'm afraid that I am more concerned than that. I think there are risks, but those risks are unknowable at the moment because no one has actually really taken the debate forward. The government is denying that it's required, but of course the IMF and other international regulators are pushing Australian regulators to make a more coherent strategy around bail-in. And the reason bail-in is important is because it stops a bank failing, because essentially deposits are converted to equity in the bank, and that keeps the bank solvent. So I can't give you a more definitive answer than that. Okay, this is from Scott. How would a moderate to strong devaluation of the Aus dollar impact the banking system and their funding, especially if the RBA is forced to lift rates to stem the devaluation? Very interesting question, very complex question. Of course, the fact of the matter is we know that banks in Australia have significant funding from overseas sources. So there is an exchange rate exposure. Now, they do tend to hedge some of that, but essentially it could be an issue ahead. The broader issue is that if the exchange rate drops, international investors may find investing in Australia less attractive. And that may mean that banks will be unable to continue to get the liquidity that they required to be able to manage their businesses effectively. Now, 14 of the banks or thereabouts have access to the Reserve Bank Liquidity Facility via APRA. And that basically means that in the short term at least, they would be able to continue no problem at all. But in the medium to long term, the lack of liquidity could be an issue. And of course, in the 2007-08 period around the global financial crisis, it was liquidity that created all of the issues internationally, partly because of lack of trust and partly because there was just no investors willing to take the risk. So if the exchange rate goes down, we're going to be importing inflation. It's probably a sign of weakness in the local economy, and therefore international investors may stay away. And then your second point was, maybe the Reserve Bank will be then required to lift interest rates to try and attract some of that investment back. Now, that's true, that could happen. But the signals from the Reserve Bank is that they are prepared to sacrifice the Aussie dollar on the altar of maintaining inflation. So I'm not sure how seriously we should take that other alternative. Now, Dennis said, Zero Hedge several days ago carried an article stating that the chief economist at NAB had declared that Australia is in recession. It's not mentioned by local media. Have you heard of it? It's not quite the story. So basically, the NAB put out their most recent business survey. And as part of that, they made the point that the retail sector, not the whole economy, but the retail sector, was actually potentially in recession. So that's where that headline has come from. It's been mistranslated, I think, or misreported. The other source, of course, is the per capita recession around GDP. Because over the last two quarters, from a per capita GDP perspective, we have been in a recession. But no one, I think, would say that currently, on the official figures at least, would see the total economy in recession at this stage. Now, it may well be that we get to that, but I think that's the true story. So it's the retail sector that I think is where the action is at the moment with regard to potential recessions. And Harmony said, thank you so much for your videos and blog posts. My question is, do you think Australian house prices will see any kind of reduction in 2020? Or are we already at the bottom of the market and will prices stagnate from now? And also, if it's going to be another 6 to 12 months wait before it's worth buying, should we tie up our savings on like a foreign term deposit for 6 months? Or would that be foolish? Okay, so two questions there. The first relates specifically to trajectory of home prices. So I said in my scenarios that I felt that things had changed quite dramatically from a couple of months ago. I'm expecting to see home prices going sideways now for a little while. There might be even a slight bounce. But the fundamentals in the local economy here would suggest to me that that will probably fade later in the year into next year. So my central predictions are still that home prices have further to fall, although a number of other people are suggesting that it has bottomed and it's going to wobble along the bottom and then rise again. I personally don't think that we're going to see significant rises in home prices over the next 2 to 5 years because of the economic circumstances that we find ourselves in. So I don't think there's any real drive to need to buy now. And I know that a lot of people have been spooking the market. I know there are a lot of first-time buyer incentive schemes being talked about. But my own view is I think there's plenty of time. And then your second question is, so what should you do in the meantime? Well, if you want to take a position vis-a-vis foreign exchange, you know, the chances are the Aussie dollar will be lower. Let's say 65 cents, 66 cents, 64 cents over the next few months. So potentially investing in US or maybe even in the euro or something like that may be to your advantage. However, of course, there are many more risks attached, because the exchange rate could move the other way. We could have a recession in the US. We could have a recession in Europe. And in those circumstances, it would mean that essentially the exchange rate movements may not be as expected. So you're taking extra risk. And the question is that extra risk worth the return you might or might not get? My own view is it's a line ball decision, given where things are at the moment. Okay, so the next question comes from Graham. What do you think is likely to happen with superannuation cash funds in the event of depositor bail-ins to rescue the banks? A substantial fraction of these funds are held in term deposits at the major banks. Yeah, so the point about that is that those superannuation cash funds are held within the trustee structures of the corporate structures of the major superannuation entities, which means that they don't necessarily behave the same way as retail deposits. And so far as I can tell, therefore, they may not be subject to bail-in. And by the way, they may also not be subject to the $250,000 deposit insurance scheme in the case of a bank failure. But the whole bail-in situation is very vague, as I said earlier on, and I think this has to apply to this too. It might be worth your asking your superannuation fund as to what they think the answer is. You might be surprised. They might give you an answer, but don't hold your breath. Austin has said, for tonight's live session, well, it's nearly live, sorry, it's 24 hours late, but there you go. For tonight's live session, would you be able to cover my question? As some of your listeners are at the age of 30 plus, are you able to tell us how it's like back in the days when property doubled every few years? And how is it different from now going forward? I would really appreciate to know more from your experience. Okay, what you're saying is I'm very old. Yes, I know I'm very old. I've been around since the 70s, right? So I have seen a number of cycles. I was in the UK for a number of property corrections, and I've seen them in other places too, and I've studied them around the world. So this is something which does happen from time to time. We've had a unique situation in the last 20 years, thanks to financial deregulation, thanks to very loose lending standards, thanks to very low interest rates, post the GFC particularly. And so this run-up in home prices that we've seen is unusual. In the prior decades, when I started investing in property, there were some run-ups, but nothing like we've seen. But we also had some corrections. So in the UK, for example, I bought a property, I swapped it a couple of times as I moved with my jobs, and then when I needed to move again, there had been a correction and I lost about 30% of value in my property because I had to move. And it took me quite a long time to recover from that scenario. But I still held property, and then it started to go up again, went up for another 5 or 6 years, and then there was another correction in the UK. So in the case of 2 decades or so, we had quite a significant period of growth and 2 corrections. And that, I think, is the sort of situation that we will normally expect to see. However, I think now we're likely to move into a rather different phase in the property sector, particularly in Australia, where perhaps there will be very little property price growth for many years. And the closest parallel is somewhere like Japan, where effectively, thanks to very, very low interest rates, in fact, negative interest rates, thanks to all the stimulus and everything else, property prices have really hardly moved at all. And if you go back over the longer period, if you look over the not just the past 2 decades, but let's say the last 100, 150 years, in fact, for most of that period of time, there was very little home price growth. And so the reason that we've had home price growth is more to do with the financialization of property, the growth in the financial services sector overall, to the point where it's strangling out, I think, other investment opportunities, particularly for productive use. And so it's quite difficult to sort of try and predict what's going to happen. But as I say, my own view is don't expect significant home price growth ahead. That was an aberration. That was a set of policies that I think will be looked back upon in the future as incorrect, inappropriate, frankly, pretty damn stupid. and we need to get back to a more even keel. And what I would say to you is that property should be considered not as an investment vehicle, but it should be fundamentally thought about as somewhere to live, to provide shelter, to provide a place to live for you and your family. And if you think of it like that, as a utility rather than investment, then perhaps you shall think differently about the type of property you buy and when you buy and what you may buy. Just to repeat myself, property as a financial speculative asset is unusual in the history of property. And I think we can associate it with some deregulation, low interest rates, and other factors. But it may not happen again for some time. And Jamie asks, hello, Martin, what is the single biggest item you would change to enable a healthier economy? Well, in fact, that runs on from the previous answer in a way. There's two factors. The first is moving away from seeing property as a financial speculative asset would be the first thing. Seeing it as somewhere to live, seeing it as somewhere to put your roots down, you know, and basically have somewhere to live. But the second part of it is we need to change the relative risk thinking between lenders lending on property relative to lending for productive business purposes. The biggest issue we have at the moment in Australia and in other countries too is the lack of funding for productive business purposes. Essentially, what's happened is for a decade or two or three now, banks have lent more and more and more to the property sector, have inflated property prices, have been able then to lend more, inflated their balance sheets, created significantly enhanced profitability from that process. But it is all non-productive. And so there's been a wealth transference to shareholders of the banks, and there's been a reduction in the ability to lend to productive purposes in the economy. So the change I would make is to move away from that and turn it around to allow and force the banks to lend for productive business purposes. Now, if they don't want to do that, what I would consider doing is creating a national bank. That bank is specifically there to lend for productive investment purposes, for infrastructure building, for supporting businesses as they grow, because that's how you actually create real growth in the economy rather than this spurious growth relating to very high home prices and everything else that we've seen for the last two or three decades. Now, that's a really big switch. The end of financialization of property is a big call, but I think, frankly, that's what we need. And the last question, it's a bit of a long one, but it's worth exploring, I think. With regard to the scenarios and the price falls, you talk about 12 to 36 months. So my question is, when you say that, for example, the price will fall 30%, do you mean one, the ultimate peak to fall from mid-2017 to mid-2019-20? Or do you mean 24 to 36 months from now, meaning that prices will fall a further 30% in the period? So that's a good question. It's one that I probably should have explained further. This is the current summary outcomes from my scenarios, and you can see their home price movements. Okay. And I'm basically saying 24 to 36 months later. Now, these are not annual movements. These are peak to trough movements. So what I'm really saying is that in the doomsday scenario, we'd see peak to trough falls of somewhere between 20 and 30%. In the Armageddon scenario, we see falls of 30 to 45%. Now, you're quite right in saying that, of course, we've already seen some falls. So on average in Sydney, we've already seen falls in the last year of 10%, in fact, nearly 16% in some areas if you take a peak-to-trough fall. And in Western Australia, for example, we've seen peak-to-trough falls now of close to 20%, and in Northern Territories, even more. So yes, I work from peak-to-trough rather than annualized. And that allows, of course, some up and down variation through the next 2 to 3 years. So I've had the view for some little time that there will be a little bit of a recovery in prices over the next few months because of all this activity now from the Reserve Bank and from APRA to try and stimulate the housing sector. But I ultimately think it will be unsuccessful, which is why the bulk of my scenarios still predict further home price falls. However, if the Reserve Bank is successful, if they do manage to get the employment rate, the unemployment rate down to 4.5%, then you could see prices begin to rise a little. But my own view is that the price rises will be quite slow, even in the most positive scenario, and we're not going to see anything like the growth that we had in the previous decade. Could be proved wrong, but that's how my scenarios work. So I hope that's answered your question. It's peak to trough rather than an annualized view, and I'm not taking the view from now. I'm taking it essentially from the scenarios when we've been running them over the last year or so, I suppose. So think of this potentially then as an indication of where I think prices could be by the end of 2020. So I hope that's been useful. I thank you all for your questions, and I'm sorry I didn't get to them on the live stream, but I have now fulfilled my obligation to you to provide some responses. If you've got a follow-up question you'd like to send me, drop me a note back and I'll try and help. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.